This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Right away. I think you could probably point to any Urban Tilt staff member and see a success story. You look at Tanya Polito. I met her the first day out in this garden. I was watering after the after-school program. She came up.
I went up to her and I was like, I'm really fed up with everything that's happening here, and I'm fed up with the refinery and all these problems that are happening, and I want to see change. There was this flame in me, so when I talked to people, it just kind of came out. So she saw that, and she was like happy to meet me, but she was like, okay, you know, calm down, it's all right. And she kind of just took me under her wing after that.
She just won the Brower Award for Youth Environmental Stewardship. It's a national honor, coming from a place where she didn't know what to do with herself and thought of herself as like kind of one of the bad kids, kind of hanging out, not going to class, to now just an absolute and utter leader.
Yeah. That was Doria Robinson, who's the executive director of Urban Tilt.
Great. And I'm wondering, so it seems like these stories, they're all kind of, they're different, but they all have these overlaps. What exactly, how did you choose your locations? How did you choose Richmond, California, the Willamette Valley, the farm near Forest Grove?
Well, we chose the Willamette Valley because we live here. And I mean, it makes it easy. We were looking all over the country, but I kept saying to Elaine, you know, we really got to look at our own region, because this is one of the great places for growing local organic food. SunGold, as I mentioned, I actually started shopping at SunGold Farmers Market stand at the Interstate Farmers Market, which is no more, about 7 years ago. And I met Chris Hurdle, who's the son of Vicki Hurdle, who's the matriarch of the farm. And we reconnected with them a couple years ago at a Friends of Family Farmers, Farmers and Ranchers Day down at State Capitol in Salem, and they had this kind of indoor farmers market. And there we met Vicki, and Elaine and I talked to her and did a short interview and kind of fell in love with her. So they were easy.
One of our main priorities is that people are good in front of the camera, and Vicki is a natural. She's a farmer. She's clear spoken and straightforward, and they were very appealing. And they're fifth generation farmers. It made this amazing change. And then Barbara located Willow, who is growing grains. They used to say that you couldn't grow red wheat in the Willamette Valley. Well, Willow has proved them wrong, and having a really hard time with her husband over 6 years, him allowing her to take some of their farm and transition it off. And let's be clear, they're still growing a lot of grass seed and a lot of white wheat that gets exported to Asia and to Europe. But I don't know what percentage.
One-tenth
of the farm is now being transitioned into organic, and they're intending to continue to expand that. It's wheat and it's grains.
Actually, that's a 5,500-acre farm, so it's a pretty large farm. And the story of how we got connected with them, we met with Harry McCormick a couple years ago, who's kind of the grandfather of organics.
We've had him on the show.
Yeah, he's a great guy. And he was talking about this grass seed farm, Stalford Seed Farms, where they're doing all these experiments, and this was about 2 years ago. And they actually, at that point, had a lot of production of red wheat and some other organic grains, quite a range. And he mentioned Willow. And then right after that, I read an article, I think it was in the Oregonian, actually, where they made mention of Stafford Seed Farms and Green Willow Grains in Willow Coberly. And I thought, I got to call her. So I called her up, and she was great on the phone. Mm-hmm. Actually, when we interviewed her, the first time we interviewed her, she was really nervous, and she wasn't sure she wanted to be in the film. And that's kind of common with some people. And she was quite good. But since then, as we've been building a relationship with her and with Harry, her husband, who we didn't think we were going to get along with, and we love him. He is quite a character and quite a visionary in a lot of ways. And they are just wonderful in front of the camera. And I think part of it is the relationship we built with them, and part of it is who they are and they care about what we're doing and what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. We also wanted to do an urban farm, and Barbara was looking at different places, looking at some fairly well-known farms in the Bay Area, and she came across Doria Robinson and had a conversation with Doria, and Doria is amazing. She is she lets you into their reality, you know, and their program is so inspiring.
Yeah, I wondered why you went to California rather than maybe the Urban Collective or something here in Portland or one of the Old Salt farms.
Well, we did actually talk with Village Gardens, which is a sort of similar program to Urban Tilt, but at that point, when it took a long time to connect with them, and by that time we'd already done several interviews down in Richmond, and we're sure that Urban Tilt was going to be in, and it was a bit repetitive. One of the reasons we wanted the film to be bigger than Oregon, we wanted to show this as a movement, and we were really concerned about the food justice piece. And when I talked to Doria the first time on the phone, I was blown away with the way that she could pull together every aspect of social justice and tie it back into food and growing food and that way of growing the community. And she is just one of these amazing, charismatic, articulate, and beautiful people who's really doing inspiring and difficult work. And we also looked at Richmond, because Richmond, maybe outside of Detroit, is one of the hardest communities in the country.
Where is Richmond?
Right north of Berkeley. Richmond is the forgotten part of the Bay Area.
Oh, okay.
And its per capita income is, like, I think, one-half to two-thirds of the rest of the Bay Area and even the rest of Contra Costa County. And actually, Contra Costa County, where Richmond's in, is one of the wealthier counties in the Bay Area. It's very suburban. But then Richmond is where all the refineries are, the chemical plants. It's basically Cancer Row down there.
And it's a true food desert.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like a cliche of the overlooked community. It's like it's toxic, it's a bad neighborhood, there's violence there. They release prisoners from San Quentin into that neighborhood when they come out of prison. It's a tough neighborhood. And to see this community building and these like the story of Tanya that was on the clip, where she was thinking of herself as a bad kid and not going to school, and now she's in UC Berkeley and she's taking on a leadership, more and more of a leadership position.
And she won an award.
She won a national award, yeah. And she's just an amazing young woman. And they have other, I asked Doria, how do you find these people? People think these people don't exist. And she says, they find me. That there are more people that are ready, their lights are dim, but they're ready to come right at it if you give them an opportunity. And the other thing about our film is we've been filming over 2 years. So we have a depth of story, and we've formed relationships of trust, and also following what their challenges are and what their stories are over 2 years. We're still farming. We're still filming
and farming for
that. We're farming for the stories, we'll continue through the summer, and hopefully to finish the film. The film is not just coming out. The screening is a shortcut. It's 20 minutes of a feature-length film. And hopefully by the end of the year, the film will be done.
So you have 20 minutes finished. That was what I was going to ask you. And you intend to have a full-length film by the end of the year. Will you be still focusing on the same three characters?
Yeah. The stories, actually, they're always evolving. And we kind of made jokes in the beginning about, you know, how it wasn't a funny joke. It was just kind of this irony of, like, we're showing these two beautiful places in Oregon without, they don't look like they have any problems. It's gorgeous in Oregon. And then here's Richmond, where they have so many issues they're dealing with. And how do we bring these two together so it doesn't look like, you know, everything bad happens in Richmond, everything good happens in Oregon? Well, there's a lot of struggles going on in Oregon, the biggest one being around GMO introduction into the valley and canola. And Harry Stalford and Willow Corboy are in the forefront of fighting that. So that's a story that's in flux that we're going to continue with. And
yeah.
Then Richmond is always a story in flux. There's a lot of kind of crises going on in Richmond all the time. Interestingly, the big thing when we were first filming there 2 years ago, there had been a lot of drive-by shootings. And the neighborhood, the first time we went out shooting in the neighborhood, the streets were empty. I mean, people were just terrified. Well, 2 years later, a year and a half later, we were there shooting in February. There hadn't been any shootings in like almost in a year and a half. And the violence in Richmond was going down while it was unfortunately going up in Oakland and San Francisco. There was a shooting a couple weeks after we left, but it's still, the violence level is really down in Richmond. But then there's all kinds of issues of the pollution of the town and the relationship between the community and Chevron and the ongoing battles there. So there's a lot more story there.
There's more story.
And it's like at some point we have to stop.
Yeah.
Well, I found it. I watched the 20-minute clip that you allowed me to, and my question was, why another food film? But immediately, since I started watching it, I was glued to it.
That's a good question.
20 minutes went zoom, zoom. But that was my first. When you first told me that you were doing this film on food security, I was like, there's so much of this out there.
I'm actually kind of curious about what drew you in. I mean, let's see if it's what our goals were.
I love the characters, you know, and I really liked that. And I can't remember which one, but one of the women you know, she was, one of her kids was sick, and she was saying to her husband, "Hey, you know, are we going to keep spraying the fields here? Or
that's Willow.
Yeah, okay. All right." So that struck me. You know, it just, it was local. It felt at home. It felt like something I hadn't really seen before. And another thing that really struck me is that it's the women in all three cases that are taking on the initiative to make the changes on the food front.
I think that the real difference between our film and a lot of the other film foods,
food films,
is that these are personal stories, in-depth personal stories. So yeah, it's not all over the place, and it's not a lot of experts. Or it's these, you know, it's showing the power of people who are having the courage to change and to take risk, like with Stalwart Seed Farms. They're taking a lot of risk growing the organics, and that's not their financial right now is not their primary concern. Willow is so committed to feeding her community locally, and it's like, it's very inspiring. These stories are very inspiring. The you know, the Sungold family, you know, they've been in dairy for generation upon generation and got sort of forced out by EPA regulations.
As did many dairy farmers since I was a child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's happened. All the food is, there's very little food being grown in the Willamette Valley. And they're a wonderful example of a family that wanted to stay on the land and found this beautiful spot for themselves where they're doing much better than they ever did in dairy.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the pieces that we really wanted to bring into our film, which isn't really clear in a lot of the food films, is the social justice piece, and to show the connections between people who are really making changes in farming practices out on the in the land and in the city, and to show that there is a real strong connection between rural agriculture and urban agriculture. And part of my contention anyway is that one of the reasons why there are food deserts like Richmond, California, are actually parts of the East County and East Multnomah County, is that there isn't enough food being grown locally anymore. And the fact that the Willamette Valley used to grow lots and lots and lots of produce and edible grain and now it's just growing grass seed doesn't help to make food available, healthy food and local food available to communities. So we're trying to show that in a way that engages people. And as Elaine said, I think the big engagement is the personal story part.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about that kind of social justice. So at one point, Daria says, "We were told not to do it," you know, when they were starting, and this is then 5 or 6 years after they had started the garden program. And, you know, it seemed like after a lot of hard work going against the grain and growing the garden and program that Daria has a lot to be proud of. So I'm interested what you think is going to happen with the Just Food movement in the next 5 or 6 years.
Well, actually, one of the things that was really exciting to hear about, I wish we could have gone there, but right after we were filming in Richmond in February, Urban Tilth went to D-Town Farm in Detroit. And I've seen photos and we're about to get some video of the meeting. But I think it's such a powerful thing to have these two completely ignored communities that are on the decline, supposedly, in the eyes of the mainstream, who are finding ways to feed themselves and finding ways to reinvent their communities through agriculture, and to have them put their brains together and see what they can do. And I think that there's going to be a lot more of that. And Doria talks about connecting globally, like all the communities, indigenous communities, communities of color, poor communities that are being pushed to the sidelines by the powers that be, are finding each other and finding another way of creating a powerful network. So I think that's part of what we're going to see. Mm-hmm. And I also think that what Willow and Harry are doing in Stalwart Seed Farms, in like figuring out how to grow grain locally for local markets, to kind of counteract the commodity grain thing, which leaves us really in a very dangerous situation, whether it's because of natural disasters, whether it's because of geopolitical conditions, or just because of the problems with industrial agriculture.
Or running out of petroleum.
Yeah, that I think that this is a really powerful model. And what's a good reason why we chose them to be in the film, because I think they're modeling something that isn't shown in any other film that I've seen.
Yeah, I think. And you know, I'd also like to add that the videography is beautiful. And the audio, of course, is Barbara's fine award-producing audio. So together, it's a very encouraging everyone to to get a chance to see this. But before we tell people where they can see it, let's just ask you if there's something else you'd like to share with our listeners.
Well, one of the big parts of making a film is raising money to pay for it. So we are in the middle of one of those crowdfunding campaigns. We're working with Indiegogo, which is like Kickstarter, only it's a little easier to work with, especially as a nonprofit. So we have an Indiegogo campaign going on. We're trying to raise $20,000. We're almost 20% there now, and we've got another 5 weeks to go of the campaign. And if you want to help us out, you can go to Indiegogo.com/projects/gaining-ground, or you can just go to Indiegogo.com and put in the search bar Gaining Ground, and I think we do come up. You might put movie or Elaine Velasquez or something else to get you there.
Can we leave that at the desk?
Yeah, and also you have a benefit preview screening coming up on June 1st at 7 p.m. at the Fifth Avenue Cinema. That's 510 Southwest Hall Street. Gaining Ground will be showing the 20-minute version?
Yes, we're showing the 20-minute version, and then after that we're speaking with the farmers here in Oregon. So Harry Stalford and Willow Cobley will be there, and Vicki Hurdle will be there. And we'll be having a discussion, which I think should be really interesting.
Oh, it sounds interesting. Well, thanks so much for being here, and I hope everyone can get to that June 1st showing.
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you very much for having us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah. There ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you a ripe one. Don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring. Eat them in the summer. All winter without them, the culinary bummer. I forget all about that, sweating and digging every time I go out and pick me a big one. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What would life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes. You can go out to eat, that's for sure, but it's nothing a homegrown tomato won't cure. Put them in a salad, put them in a stew, you can make your very own tomato juice. Eat them with eggs, eat them with gravy, eat them with beans, pinto or navy. Put them on the side, put them in the middle, put a homegrown tomato on a hot cake griddle. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes, what is life? Up homegrown tomatoes.
That's Misty River singing Homegrown Tomatoes. We need a song about homegrown grains, but homegrown tomatoes are also awesome. You are listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Kate Welch. A new book is out that is all about the plants that create the world's great drinks. The title is The Drunken Botanist and is written by Amy Stewart. The Drunken Botanist lists over 150 plants, flowers, trees, fruits, and all in alphabetical order. Amy Stewart presents a botanical history of each plant with some science and chemistry, plus there are recipes and gardening advice. When it comes to alcohol, I have to ask, is this food? But then, looking through the plants in this book, I see wheat and rice and other food grains like barley and sorghum, as well as flowers. There are roses and marigold and fruits from apricots to yuzu. Plus, she lists trees and desert plants. Well, all sorts of plants are used to make spirits for our cocktails. So, now, I had the chance to talk to Amy Stewart when she was here in Portland. She gave a talk at Powell's. So she stopped by the KBOO studio, and here's the interview with her. Thank you so much, Amy, for coming into the KBOO Food Show.
Oh, thanks.
This is your sixth book.
Yes, that's right.
And we are talking about The Drunken Botanist that has just been released.
Brand new.
Tell our listeners about The Drunken Botanist.
Well, the idea behind the book was to look at all the different plants that we make into alcohol. So everything that gets actually fermented and distilled, like grapes and corn and barley, and then all the plants that are used at the distillery to flavor things. So all the flavorings that go into gin or any kind of liqueur, those are all plants. And then in the last part of the book, I look at just garnishes and mixers, things people might grow in their gardens and use to make a drink. So really, it's following the whole process, but it's all about the plants.
It's sort of like a dictionary.
Yeah.
Alphabetical order, you can choose
your
plant and say, what are they using this for? I loved it. I'm going to keep it as a reference book.
Yeah, it was fun, and it is. It's got that very encyclopedic kind of quality going plant by plant. So I get into, you know, spirits that are made all over the world. I mean, I tried not to be too focused on North America and Europe, but to look at Africa and South America and Asia and India. So it's very global in that way.
I had the interesting opportunity one day. I was visiting a neighbor, and he said, oh, you've got to try this. And he pulled out a bottle of, and you're going to help me pronounce this, Chinese baijiu?
Uh-huh, baijiu, sure.
Baijiu,
yeah. Uh-huh.
That's how I pronounce it. And it's made from sorghum.
That's right.
And sorghum is the most highly used, is that correct? The most highly used plant to make alcohol?
I think so. This is sort of a theory that I'm working on. You know, I put all the numbers in the book. It's hard to get figures out of Africa and out of China. But I believe that if you take the best estimates, that it looks like there's more alcohol consumed from sorghum than from grapes or barley or any other plant anywhere in the world.
And older.
It is. It's a very old grain and very tough. It can survive drought, so it's been used as a staple food in famines and has really kept people alive for centuries.
You know, when I first had the opportunity last year to do some tastings of different alcohols that had been infused with flavors, mm-hmm. I thought, oh, what does this have to do with food? And I'm still going to ask that question. What does it have to do with food? Is there any nutrient in alcohol?
Oh, well, okay. So in terms of nutritional value, I think it's important that we remember that before you could consume enough of a particular plant in a cocktail to get any nutritional value out of it or any medicinal value, you would have already poisoned yourself with alcohol. You would have to consume so much that the alcohol would start to become the overriding factor. So let's not fool ourselves that these are health drinks. Now, I mean, there's plenty of good evidence that a drink or two won't hurt you and in some cases might even be a little bit good for you. But
a cocktail to kind of inspire your appetite?
It could be. And that's actually a very good point in terms of food, which is that I write about a lot of plants that are used in aperitifs that really do stimulate the appetite. And there actually is good science behind how that works. Gentian root, for instance, is in the book. And there's very good science behind how even swishing a solution of gentian around in your mouth stimulates the nerve endings to produce saliva and gastric juices and can be very helpful for people who are maybe recovering from cancer treatments and can't quite get there eating habits back. So there is good science behind some of these.
Okay, so we
old
can justify
remedies.
Being on the food show a little bit.
a little bit.
So I have a couple questions that I listened to you on Morning Edition.
Oh, right.
Yeah. They asked you how you decided to write about the drunken botanist, mm-hmm. and you said that you and your friends were in the liquor store and all the alcohols were plants to you, and
right.
somebody should write the book. But, and so, okay, sure, I'll go out and write the book, but there's a lot of information in here.
Yes.
How did you gather your information?
You know, like all my books, it's a big research project. So for every plant that's in the book, there is a botanist somewhere who has devoted their lives to the study of it. And, you know, I track people down and interview them and travel around and visit distilleries and visit farms and just talk to as many people as possible.
How long did it take you to write this book then?
Well, my books are generally 2 years apart, uh-huh. but there's always overlap in terms of the research. So I've probably been working on it for longer than that.
Mm-hmm. Did you travel the world for it?
I managed to get to some distilleries in Europe and the UK, but I didn't get as far as I would like. You know, there are definitely remote places where I would have loved to have gone and sampled some stuff, but there's a limit to how much
of
that I can do.
I was just going to ask you about some samples. And how do you have something that you found particularly interesting or that you particularly liked?
Well, you know, one of the things that really, for me, that I really learned is how drinkable really good vermouth is. And here in Portland, you have Imbue vermouth. Have you had Imbue?
No, I don't think I'm not really a big alcohol drinker.
Well, vermouth, this Imbue vermouth is fantastic. It's made here in Portland, and it's very drinkable on its own. So it's not something that's just used as a mixer. You know, all vermouth is wine with herbs and fruit and spices infused in it, and a little bit of extra alcohol added to bring the proof up just a little bit. But if I go into a bar here in Portland and I see Imbue behind the bar, I just want equal parts sweet and dry vermouth as a drink. It's fantastic. And another one of those great before dinner drinks definitely gets the appetite going.
Ah, good.
Yeah, and very, very good with food too, very drinkable with food.
I guess my favorite is gin, and I recently noticed that the Crater Lake gin is hand-picked junipers. And
yes.
I just love that taste, and part of that, I think, for me, comes from I grew up in the forest uh-huh. where we had balsam spruce trees.
Oh, sure.
And they get these little bubbles on the tree trunk, and you mm-hmm. take your thumbnail and you burst the bubble, and uh-huh. you take a taste of that balsam
right.
syrup. And to me, that juniper berry...
Yeah.
It's reminiscent of the balsam.
Right. It's that tree flavor. Well, another great one that is also from here in Portland is Clear Creek Distillery does this Douglas Fir Eau de Vie. And this is one of the places I came to do research. I interviewed Stephen McCarthy, who owns Clear Creek. And the only way he could get the right flavor and the right color out of the little growing tips of Doug fir trees was to actually take buckets of spirit out into the forest and drop them directly in, because if they were picked and transported even a little way to be added to the alcohol, they would oxidize and go bad. So they actually had to bring the alcohol to the trees to make it.
Oh, that's fabulous.
And it's wonderful. It's a lovely flavor. Clear Creek does some incredible fruit liqueurs using things like loganberries, you know, very Pacific Northwest kind of flavors, which is just terrific.
Hmm. I don't want to take away from The Drunken Botanist, but I did look at some of your other books, although mm-hmm. obviously I didn't get to the six because I thought you had five. But I really loved looking at The Wicked Bugs.
Yes.
And
yes.
Just briefly, have you done anything with insects that people eat?
You know, I thought about that with Wicked Bugs. I mean, so the idea was Wicked Bugs and Wicked Plants are sort of a matched set. And in both cases, they're about bugs or plants that have been used to commit murder, have started wars. It's really the dark side. And it's really about their impact, their negative impact on
right.
humankind. And I thought in that about getting into bugs as food a little bit, but it just seemed like too much for a book that was otherwise about the really strictly the horrible, the murder and mayhem. You know, I was really interested in kind of the dark side. There is a little bit in Drunken and botanist about bugs in booze. It turns out that bugs play a role in all kinds of alcohol. So, because
there's these little boxes in the book, folks, right. that have little vignettes about bugs.
Bugs and booze, that's right. Yeah, there were quite a few, and I perked up. I got real excited anytime I found one.
Well, maybe 10 years down the road, you'll have the insects that we can eat when people are more interested in eating insects.
There you go.
Is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners?
Well, I hope people will think about growing some of these plants themselves. I've gotten really interested in growing plants specifically for cocktails or for, you know, infusing. One great example, especially in this region, is black currant. You know, black currant can be used to make cassis. It's a fruit that's a little tart, a little hard to take raw, but fantastic made into a fruit liqueur. And that's something that's easy to get and to grow here in the Pacific Northwest.
And is it easy to make it into the liqueur? How do you do it?
No, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, you harvest the fruit when it's ripe and you cook it with some sugar, you know, sort of mash it to break the skins and release the juice. But basically, you're just cooking it with sugar until the sugar melts and straining it off. And adding some kind of high-proof alcohol. If you want to be true to the way the French would do it, then you would use a grape eau de vie or a vodka made from grapes so that you stay within the French tradition. And that's all there is to it. I made a website for the book, which is drunkenbotanist.com, and I put a lot more recipes there because I didn't have room for so many in the book, and I also have a lot more growing information about plants you can grow in your own garden to make drinks with, and then what those drinks would be, and instructions for infusing and stuff like that.
Oh, great. And there are a lot of recipes in here.
Yeah. Well, the subtitle is The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. So I was really going for classic recipes that everyone should know how to make and just connecting them with the plants that they are really related to.
Well, I have to say that this book has given me a new interest in these spirits. I'm like, I don't know if this is a good thing or not. I think it probably is fine.
In moderation.
Everything in moderation. Even moderation.
Right.
The quote from your website is that The Drunken Botanist, it's a fascinating concoction of biology, chemistry, history, etymology, and mixology.
There you go.
Thanks so much for coming in and being on the KBOO Food Show.
Oh, thank you.
Listen, folks, and I will tell a funny story. You may think it's sad, but I was in my glory. 'Twas a cellar I crept in, cobwebs brushing by my chin, on the night I stole old Sammy Morgan's gin. As my hand fell on the jug, I had to snicker. But when I started for the door, I went much quicker. For just up above my head, someone jumped right out of bed on the night I stole Sammy Morgan's gin. That cellar, believe me, I was lifting, and the hops from one arm to the other shifting. Then I stopped and hauled the plug, sit there till I drained the jug, had my mind all set, no spare drops I was missing. Then on my feet I thought I was, but wasn't, and for roads I guess I saw about a dozen. When I reached the old porch door, I went smack on the floor on the night I stole old Sammy Morgan's gin. I just made one step and landed in the coal box. Then from off the mantel came a big Ben alarm clock. But I finally got upstairs after passing seven bears. 'Twas the night I stole Sammy Morgan's gin. By my bedroom door now stood taking tickets. Then the monkey stood before me baking biscuits. But the funniest sight of all was two roosters playing ball on the night I stole old Sammy Morgan's gin.
big as horses washing dishes. As an ape came in the door dressed up in breeches, then the floor fell on my head as I tried to get in bed. 'Twas the night I stole old Sammy Morgan's gin. Well, I woke next morning, guess 'twas closer evening, and my room is certainly in an awful shape. Someone else had took my head and left an elephant's there and stayed on the morning after drinking Sammy's gin.
And for those of you who don't recognize Hank Snow, that was Hank Snow. And the song, of course, is The Night I Stole Old Sammy Morgan's Gin. You are listening to the KABU Food Show on KABU Community Radio. I'm Kate Welch.
I'm Chris Siegel.
And our next guest is from the Village Building Convergence, but she isn't quite here yet. So we're going to tell you about a couple of other things that are going on. One of the things that's come across our email today, this was just released yesterday, and that is that the Senate Agricultural Committee has passed the Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry has amended and passed the 2013 Farm Bill by a vote of 15-5, and that means that the legislation will now move to the floor of the Senate for debate and amendment. And so this is good news. This means that the Senate is going to talk about the Farm Bill. They hopefully will pass something substantial this year. And it's just a good sign to know that it's alive and well. The Farm Bill is alive. Well, it might not be well, but at least it's alive.
Yeah. So there's now we'll be able to follow up on that. For the longest time, there's been no new word on the Farm Bill. So this doesn't mean necessarily that the Farm Bill is going to be passed or that the changes are going to happen anytime soon. But it's exciting that it'll be a part of the conversation, so that our government will be taking a look at it once again.
So this is giving Chris and me the opportunity to talk a little bit about some of the foods that we grow. And we know how lucky we are to live in Portland and in the Willamette Valley where we can grow food. We do not have a food desert, even in some of the poorer parts of town. I don't like that word, poorer, but some of the parts of town where there's maybe not a grocery, it's not Richmond. It's mm-hmm. not Richmond, California. And I am so lucky to have a little space where I can grow tomatoes and onions and beans and peas. And this year, so far, they are amazing. How's your garden, Chris?
It's going well. Yeah, the only hiccup we've had, so I run a small farm called Wealth Underground Farm. We're out near Skyline, out in the West Hills. And the only hiccup we've had so far is that we've had too much sun. We didn't get nearly as much rain as we were expecting, so we've been kind of frantically putting out irrigation on our fields. We put our onions in a little while ago, and you know, it rained and they looked great, and then all of a sudden it was just weeks of sun and no rain. And so,
did they make it?
They made it. They, you know, they might be a little bit stunted. They kind of got a little bit of yellow there.
I was lucky. I was able to irrigate during that hot spell we had. Mm-hmm. And at the very end of it was when I put the tomatoes out. And I had started my tomatoes. I don't normally do that. But I got a package of sampler seeds when I was at the Organicology Conference. And they're the blush tomatoes. I love the blush tomatoes. So I have like 20 tomato plants for my one-person garden. So, you know, stay tuned. Maybe in August I'll be bringing tomatoes to the station.
Sure,
and we'll
sure.
be eating tomatoes on the food show.
And this is a good year for tomatoes for that because...
Well, if it doesn't stay cold for the rest of the summer.
If it doesn't, right, yeah. If it doesn't get cold, but it also the tomatoes are really moisture. They have trouble with moisture. And so I know a few years ago we lost most all of our tomatoes because it was a wet season and they got blight early before they were producing tomatoes. But this year that you know on the front end won't be an issue, so the tomatoes should as starts should
I've
be
had
pretty
mixed
strong.
Luck with tomatoes in Portland and will you home lands of Indiana, boy, they have the best tomatoes.
Oh, sure. And it starts so early. Yeah, I'll get a call from my folks and they'll be telling me, you know, we'll still have a couple months before tomatoes are ready here, and they'll be telling me about all the tomatoes that they're eating from the garden. So
what other food news do you have going on, Chris?
Well, it's right now it's a very interesting time. Not interesting, it's kind of one of the more disappointing times with garden food. We're in the hungry gap, which is when all of the food that kind of overwintered, so your kale, your Brussels sprouts, you know, we had a lot of collards that overwintered, those all go to flower. And
they're tough.
And they get tough, right? And, you know, you're gonna pull those to make space for new plants. But then those new plants just aren't quite ready. So it's interesting. We are still kind of nursing our kale right now. We have our first artichokes just came. So we had a variety, the Imperial Star, that overwintered. It's a very quick variety. You can plant it, and actually it'll yield within the same year that you plant it from seed.
Oh, nice.
So that's been pretty spectacular. But, yeah, so it's kind of thin right now as far as what we're eating.
I've been feeding the old kale and the old mustard to the chickens, and they're very happy for it because I let the chickens out to free range some during the day if I'm there.
Mm-hmm.
But when I'm not there, like right now, their pen is no longer got anything green in it.
Sure.
So I've been tossing that stuff to them.
Yeah, I find that with our chickens, it'll be a certain season where we're pulling so many plants, making room for new plants, that they're excited at first, but very quickly they're like, "Where's the other food? What, you know? Do you have some corn, some grains?" They get over it pretty quickly.
So our next guest, who isn't here, is the main cook at the Village Building Convergence. But we can tell you just a little bit about the Village Building Convergence. I certainly can't speak the way she can, but I know that it's a 10-day event, and it gets underway next week, May 24th, right here in Portland. And I have heard some other programs about it. We were, of course, going to focus on food. I know that they cook, I think, 3 meals a day, but I'm not positive because Sarah's not here to tell us. And the Village Building Convergence is going to be at Alberta Abbey, 126 Northeast Alberta Street. So to get some more information, you can go to their website, which is the vbc.cityrepair.org, and I have been looking on the website to see if I could learn more about the food and what you can expect, but I haven't been successful. But I'm sure that you get up there to the Village Building Convergence, you'll find out.
Mm-hmm.
It is a really neat event. I know one year when I lived in another house in Southeast Portland over near People's Food Co-op, there were a couple of cob benches built on our street, and it was a lot of fun. And get out there on a nice warm June day and get your feet in the cob, in the mud, and make cob benches. It's fascinating.
Yeah, and it seems like they've got about 30 communities that come together, and it's a lot of discussions, conversations, but then they do a lot of work around gardens and putting in new gardens and talking about, you know, creating the community that you want. And oftentimes, you know, nowadays we want communities that where you can have access to good food. And so part of that is creating community gardens and helping people to get the skills and the abilities to have their own gardens. So there's a lot of photos on the website of, you know, people getting on their hands and knees in the dirt, working to put in some brand new community gardens.
And now we're having a food show famine.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, I have another question for Chris. Some of you may or may not know, Chris is somewhat new to our food show, but also has a real job now as the manager of the St. John's Farmers Market.
So you might have some farmer market info that you can share with our listeners. The market is underway.
Sure. Well, it's not underway yet. No.
Oh, okay.
For me, it's underway. For me, it's been underway for a while just because there's a lot of work to do. We just got all our vendors together this last week and had our meeting to kind of go through the workings of the market. But we begin on June 1st. That's our opening
day. And
that's
the St. John's Market.
That's the St. John's Farmers
June
Market.
June 1st,
yeah.
Is that a Saturday?
It is a Saturday, yeah.
And
Saturday,
so every Saturday for the summer?
Every Saturday for the summer from 9 to 2, yeah, from June 1st to October 12th. We actually just had the St. John's Bazaar, and it was really exciting. We had a tent there for the market, but it was just it had that feeling of, you know, we're ready for it to start. I know a lot of markets are already beginning, and we're talking about having a market conversation potentially in the coming food show. But it's just a really exciting season because, you know, as we're talking about the gardens, as we're talking about what's growing, what's coming together, there's all this energy and all these, you know, all these things, all these plants, all these people growing, coming together, and the market is the culmination of that. So
how many vendors at the St. John's Market? I don't think I've been to the St. John's Market, so it'll be fun to go there.
Sure. We have 30 vendors. It's, you know, we have a lot of veggie vendors. We have some hot food vendors. It's a really exciting place. It's in the plaza of St. John's, which is an amazing space. So, we're excited, and it's going to be a great season, I can tell.
Good. Oh, can't wait. And how about the cooking? Have you been cooking anything
lately?
Yeah, what have you been cooking?
I like to cook pretty much as much as possible from our farm. And so it's been kind of lax, although I will say
I've had that same problem
right, with the Hungry Gap with vegetables, we haven't had so many vegetables, but our chickens at this point are really producing, so they're,
are you getting one egg per chicken?
At this point, yeah. Yeah.
I think I should be, but I seem to only be getting three, and I think somebody's laying an egg somewhere else. Do you have any tricks to go find those eggs when they get loose?
Well, the main trick is what we do when that happens, when we think that there's a problem, is that it's kind of a bit of a punishment, but we'll leave them in the coop for, you know, if we can, if we're there for an extra couple hours, so that kind of ensures that they have to go into the box and they have to lay. And as far as like finding the eggs, sometimes it's kind of like if you have any children or kids or like
it's kind of an
activity.
Egg, huh?
Exactly, right. It's an Easter egg hunt that's not necessarily on Easter. So you get get in the mindset of the chicken and think about like, oh, where's like a comfortable, safe place for them? What's going to be like low or enclosed? And so, I don't know. Since we get so many eggs, we're not too concerned when that kind of thing happens. But and then it also might mean if they're laying somewhere else, they might want to go broody and then sit on the eggs. And for us, we have a rooster, so we kind of sometimes let that play out because then they'll hatch, you know.
Have you had them hatch?
We have had them hatch before.
And how's that gone?
It's good.
Did they survive?
It's amazing. We'll have 10 eggs under the chickens, and part of it is there's because they're sitting on multiple chickens' eggs. Part of it is the timing. We're not exactly sure how long those eggs have been in there, but we kind of leave that up to the chickens to figure out. But we generally go from about 10 eggs under them to start to about 3 or 4 chickens that come out. And then the problem is that they're generally going to hatch 50-50. So, you know, you're going to have these little roosters on your hands when you hatch them out. So, and you got to do something with them. But
do you eat them?
The roosters? We have. Yeah, we've eaten them. We've also we've given them away if there are other folks, but you know, it's hard to find anybody who's willing to take a rooster.
So, when you have little babies hatching, I know some friends had a broody hen and they put some day-old chicks under her, and she was great with them for a while, but eventually the other chickens killed them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that can be a problem. We actually had one where it was not only the other chickens, but the other, it was like one other chick got in on the mix. So you really, for us, as we've had, fortunately, our strongest chickens have gone broody. So they're like, they can become really fierce mothers.
Oh, yeah, and you don't want to get near them.
No. They'll
beast or man.
They'll defend their chicks for sure. So, but that, no, it is, it's kind of like an alarming thing. I mean, and they're 1 degree from being wild animals. So, and there are some times where, you know, they feel like pets, and then there are some times where you just like can't fathom what they just did. So yeah, we try to accommodate for the baby chicks, and we try to make safe spaces for them where they can go and be safe from the other chickens. And usually the other chickens just leave them alone. So it hasn't really been a problem.
Let's go back to the eggs for a minute. Do you have a favorite way to prepare an egg?
I mean, I'm pretty basic. I don't know. I feel like I grew up in the Midwest, you know, white bread and potatoes. And so I really do love scrambled eggs, but it's mostly because I don't necessarily like eggs by themselves. I like scrambling them with vegetables and onions and garlic. So that's my favorite way.
That's your fallback.
That's my
fallback,
just
like
for sure.
Quick breakfast with some eggs or a quick egg.
Yeah.
So yeah, do you bake at all?
Yeah, we'll do frittatas, mm-hmm. but and then, you know, right now it's we'll try to use as many eggs as possible. We'll do hard boiled eggs. We'll like cook big scrambles, and just the way that it's sunny and the birds are laying a ton, it seems like we have an endless supply at this point. So
well, that's great. We love endless supplies of eggs. See, we had a feast on eggs.
Yeah.
So thanks everyone for tuning into the KBOO Food Show. We're on the third Wednesday of each month at 11 a.m. and we'd like to thank our guests Barbara Bernstein and Elaine Valesky and Amy Stewart. Also, we'd like to acknowledge that our theme song is by Brian QTN, and we'd like to thank Kurt, our board operator. So let's go out now with an old favorite song by Tom Waits, Eggs and Sausage. Thanks for listening.
Nighthawks at the diner, Emma's 49er. There's a rendezvous of strangers around a coffee urn at night. All the gypsy hacks and the insomniacs, now the paper's been read. Now the waitress said, eggs and sausage and a side of toast, a coffee and a roll, hash browns are what easy, chili in a bowl with burgers and fries. What kind of pie? It's a graveyard charade, it's a legit masquerade. And it's 2 for a quarter, dime for a dance. Woolworth rhinestone, diamond earrings, and a sideways glance. Now the register rings, now the waitress sings. Side of toast, coffee and a roll, hash browns over easy, chili in a bowl, burgers and fries. What kind of pie? Offers no direction. It's a cold caffeine in a nicotine cloud. As the touch of your fingers lingers burning memory. I pin 86th from your ski. Now I'm in a melodramatic nocturnal scene. Now I'm a refugee from a disconcerted affair. Not a lead pipe morning fall. Not a waitress call. Eggs and sausage. Now a side of toast. Coffee and a roll. Hash browns over easy. Chili in a bowl. With burgers and fries. Now what kind of pie? Alamo, if you will. Just come in, I join the crowd. Had some time to kill. See, I just come in to join the crowd. Had some time to kill. Just come in to join the crowd. Cause I had some time to kill.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd Avenue, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 100.7 FM Corvallis in Albany. The time is 12 o'clock straight up. Coming up next, Nick Geffro with Jazz Lives.
This is KBOO News at Noon for May 15, 2013.
The U.S. Marine Corps is charging an officer who served in Afghanistan with dereliction of duty, conduct unbecoming of an officer, and failure to stop misconduct by those under his command. Captain James Clement and a number of his men are shown urinating on the corpses of Taliban soldiers in a video that was posted on YouTube. The incident caused widespread outrage and violent protests by Afghans. Two Marine sergeants have already been tried and convicted for the incident, and another enlisted soldier is awaiting trial.
Two women who are members of Cross Timbers Earth Firsters, a regional chapter of the Earth First Movement, were arrested on May 14th for demonstrating at a construction site in Oklahoma. The women chained themselves to concrete-filled barrels, blocking the use of heavy machinery working on a gas pipeline being built by Keystone KXL Construction. Members of Earth First, who are concerned about the environmental impact of the pipeline, have been demonstrating against what they see as a government-sanctioned endangerment of natural resources for over 30 years. They are also demonstrating against the tar sand extraction occurring throughout the Great Plains, which they claim is threatening local water resources and communities. This demonstration is just one of an escalating number of actions occurring in this Oklahoma area.
Worldwide levels of the chief greenhouse gases that cause global warming have hit a global record. Carbon dioxide levels are growing 100 times faster than they were at the end of the Ice Age, and government scientists blame human activity. Carbon dioxide levels have not been this high for over 2 million years, when the world was much warmer and sea levels much higher. Scientists say that the burning of fossil fuels has overwhelmingly caused this damage. An even greater threat is the speed of this change, which does not allow plants and animals to adapt, unlike previous increases that occurred over thousands of years.
A major Swedish fashion retailer with a strong presence in Bangladesh says it will sign up for legally binding fire and building regulations developed by unions. This comes after one of the worst industrial disasters on record, in which hundreds of garment workers died when a poorly constructed factory collapsed. 40 garment buyers, including Walmart and JCPenney, met with the labor rights group in Germany on April 29th to create a plan for ensuring the industry improves safety conditions in these factories. Labor groups have set today as the deadline for companies to commit to that plan. The agreement requires the garment buyers to pay for safety improvements and independent periodic safety inspections. Added pressure comes from human rights groups, with millions of members worldwide strongly endorsing these regulations.
During the past 60 years, it has cost American taxpayers between $5 and $6 trillion to produce and maintain our nuclear inventory. This represents one-fourth of our defense budget, and we still need to spend an additional $600 billion over the next decade to maintain this arsenal. When the arms race began, the military-industrial complex, the same one President Eisenhower warned us about, stressed that the huge investment in nuclear weapons that was being planned would allow for a smaller army and navy. Contrary to those promises, the cost of our army and navy has multiplied. Even though most world leaders would not consider launching a nuclear war, there seems to be little inclination to seriously reduce or eliminate the large and dangerous stockpiles of weapons that exist today.
This is Diane Erickson and Patrick Wilson with the KBOO Noon News in Portland, Oregon. Tune in every night at 5 o'clock for more local, national, and international news. Thanks for listening.
All right, it's time for Jazz Lives right here at the Boo Station with yours truly, Nick Geffro. Let's get to swinging. Thank you.